This is the I Read Comic Books Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, Editor-in-Chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week are my regular two compatriots, Paul Jaisley, comic books contributor and editor, and Nick White, comic books contributor. You guys, thank you for joining me this week. How have comic books been for you?
Well, Mike, I don't know if you're aware of this, but comics are not just for kids anymore.
What? I'm out.
I hate to break it to you.
That's actually bullshit.
I read, I realized this when I read the second volume of Sex Criminals this past week.
Which
it's not a kid's book. So
wait, it took you to the second volume to figure that out?
Well, no, I'm obviously being facetious, but I have to say I really enjoyed that second volume a lot more than the first one.
Okay.
I've never been as enamored with that series as everyone else seems to be, but those issues in particular, particularly issue 6, the first issue in that collection, I thought was a really honest and well-done portrayal of depression in a comic book. So I think I finally got what people see in the book as a series. Yeah. So I really enjoyed that. I'm kind of excited to wait till the next trade, which might be a while to finish that.
Yeah.
And what else did I read? I read the first 6 issues of Gem and the Holograms from IDW, and I absolutely loved it. as a 33-year-old,
what was so great about it?
As a 33-year-old man who for some reason loves this cartoon that was made for girls to sell Barbie dolls. It really captured what was interesting about the cartoon series, and it wasn't afraid to be as absurd and over the top and outrageous as the cartoon was. I don't want to get too much into it, but the whole premise of the book is really just about being comfortable with yourself, and the fact that they changed the way the characters are portrayed and had them drawn in a more like full-figured, more realistic body shapes and stuff, it really made it feel like a progressive book, even though it's based on a 30-year-old cartoon that was designed to sell toys. You know, it's similar to the Transformers versus G.I. Joes. It was this book. I'm like, oh, it's a licensed property that's kind of absurd, but they're able to find all the interesting ideas in it and sort of extrapolate those. So highly recommended on that.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but good things about that series, like from the beginning, even just from issue 1. I've heard nothing but praise.
Yeah, I'm kind of bummed. I don't know why I waited this long to read it. I'm so glad I finally picked it up, and I can't wait for the next arc to get started. So those are definitely the highlights of my comic book reading week.
How about you, Nick?
I've actually been pretty busy. I picked up another Valiant bundle, which added a couple extra volumes of Exo Man of War and gave me some digital back copies. So I got about halfway through The Delinquents. I finally got around to reading Shadow Man, Volumes 1 and 2. Those were kind of interesting. I can't say I really love it, but it's apparently increasingly relevant because the rumor is that Shadow Man, who's been, I think, gone for the last year and a half, is actually going to come back. Don't ask me what happened to him, but apparently that's a potential thing. I think he's supposed to come back in Ninjak in like 2 months or so.
Gotcha.
So I read those. I also started reading some Star Wars bundles I picked up. I guess they were doing, Comixology was doing a sale for that stupid thing called Force Friday.
I didn't even know that was a thing until Friday.
Yeah, like, or as everyone else calls it, go to Toy Store, go to Toys R Us and empty your bank account.
Well, I mean, the B-88 or what is it?
Yeah.
BB-8, sorry, yeah, BB-8 little toy came out, which is so cool.
Yeah,
it's the coolest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Anyway, sorry, Nick. Sorry.
No, that thing is cool. I already watched the video of the guys taking it apart. So
it's that cool.
Yeah. Wow. Oh man, we love this thing. Let's destroy it. No. So I read some of it's some really we're talking like really old Star Wars stuff, like the original comics that portrayed the first movie, which interestingly enough were drawn by Howard Chaykin, who's still drawing to this day. On Satellite Sam, so that's really interesting. And some other, I think I got a collection of Rogue Squadron, and you might find this kind of interesting, Paul. They collected a bunch of, there's actually a newspaper strip that was Star Wars that ran from 81 to 84, and it was written by Archie Goodwin.
Okay.
And obviously that name's familiar to you, Mike. I don't know if that rings
I have
much
no idea who that is, and I'm sure that any of our listeners have no idea who that is.
Sure. Arguably one of the most famous editors of Batman, probably right up there with Denny O'Neill and also a pretty well-known Batman writer.
Yeah.
I don't know if Paul has anything to add other than maybe I got that wrong, but I think that's
no, correct. I think you're exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And beyond that, gosh, I just read Batman 43 today and Ivar Time Walker 8, and both of those were amazing because a minor spoiler alert at the end of Ivar 8, Ivar appears to be dead.
Oh my. So, that's kind of a big deal.
That's how they wrapped arc number 2. Yeah, I mean, that's a way to keep people coming back.
Right. Wowzer. Well, for me, this week, I actually managed to sit down, despite all of the... I had a bunch of crazy stuff going on with work, but I did manage to sit down and read a bunch of my digital books that I've been slacking on. I didn't actually go pick up comic books, period, so I didn't... I didn't pick up my physical books, I should say. So I missed out on Wolf, or Material number 4, which, yeah. And... But I did manage to... I talked to a guy that I work with, and he recommended... He said, Mike, you got to try Bizarro number 1 just because of how goofy and fun it is. Hmm. So I nabbed a copy of that. I read that and Dying in the Dead number 3, which has had like a massive delay due to what Jonathan Hickman basically described at the end of the book as... since issue number 1 was like 60 pages, they actually used up all of their leeway time to try to push out that issue to make it, come out on, like to make 60 issues come out on time. So now they've decided to take a break, and I think that Dying in the Dead isn't going to return until next year. So we're probably looking at like a January release for number 4, which is insane. But, the quality of that book in terms of art, I'd much rather give the artist whose name I cannot remember off the top of my head.
I was just going to ask, yeah.
I'd rather give him time to actually... I've got it right here. I'd rather give him time to work on the book than actually, push out like a shitty book. I don't know. I don't know how to describe that. But
Bring in a backup artist.
Yeah, no.
Those are my favorite.
They don't do these things at Image. So I read that. I also read Lazarus number 19. And this past week, I did read all... Secret Wars 1-5. So we're not gonna have to talk about that, even though I talked shit about Secret Wars for so long. I did end up picking all of them up because at the end of the day, Dr. Doom is the god. He's Doom God. He's controlling the universe. It's like everything that I would ever want in a comic book. Why wasn't I buying it? And it's the only answer I could say is because it was a crossover, which is a bad excuse if it's a very good comic book. And it just so happens that Secret Wars is a pretty good comic book. The turn that they've taken in the book as of issue number 5 has been it reminded me that there has to be a conclusion in this book and that it can't just be Doom running the world for forever. So we're probably going to get kicked back to whatever Marvel's old ways of thinking were, or whatever they decide will be, the new future for Marvel. But nonetheless, it the first 2 or 3 issues are something that I could reread over and over just because of how cool they are. Just like the world that they set up where Doom controls everything. So the only book I didn't read from last week was Silver Surfer 14, even though that's one of my favorites. I left it for last because it was supposed to be like a nice dessert plate that I was going to have, but I haven't gotten to it yet. So I will be having dessert for breakfast tomorrow.
Oh, boy. I can just imagine the meeting between Marvel and Jonathan Hickman where they're like, all right, like, you realize this story has to end at some point. Like, you will have to wrap this up. And he's don't worry, guys. I got it plotted out for 30 issues. And they're like,
compress it down to 8.
How about...
And then they changed their mind and said, no, compress it down to 9. It'll be fine. They edited
we're
going to
give you one extra issue. Just throw the rest in there.
I find that so bizarre. I mean, for a writer that's known to be so meticulous in his planning... to all of a sudden say, like, you know what, I'm going to need an extra issue. I didn't foresee that coming. Like, that just seems so strange. Cause
totally.
Isn't that Hickman's sort of, reputation as being a guy who everything is planned out and plotted so meticulously, he kind of should know how many issues it's going to take, if not already have them written.
Or, it begs the question of whether or not this is really, truly a Hickman decision.
Yeah, and that's...
Right, exactly.
That's the question right there. I think, is there a editorial decision? Was there, like, a company-wide... direction decision that was made? Who knows?
So are they waiting till that series wraps up before they start launching all the new number ones?
I thought
they're trying to give them more breathing room for that.
Yeah,
maybe?
I thought that was the case. Nick was telling me before the show, in the pre-show, that wasn't the case. That they're actually going to start releasing post Secret Wars books before Secret Wars concludes. So
yeah, I think there was an interview with Axel Alonso.
It's the most confusing thing. It's so confusing. I don't know. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, and it's not like it hasn't been done before by the big two. I mean, they've all been guilty of it at some point or another. This shit just happens, and at some point you just have to take a hit.
And it also begs the question of where Secret Wars actually concludes, because there is a chance that Secret Wars may conclude in issue 7 or 8, and issue 9 might be like just a giant epilogue. And in that case, everything's revealed in 8, and we'll finally get Uncanny X-Men number 600, and I can just sit down and be happy with my life that Bendis wrapped up his final arc. But I mean, I'm not angry. Don't worry.
Yeah.
but there's a good chance that they'll do that. I mean, Marvel is notorious for their epilogues, and especially with big crossover events like this. Comic picks for this week. I'm actually going to go first, because Paul and Nick picked the same book. So, yeah, it's insane. It's insanity. So this week, Bitch Planet number 5 is my pick. And I am so absolutely excited for this book, because there's been massive delays. And Kelly Sue DeConnick, I follow her newsletter, her and Matt Fraction's newsletter that they put out for Milkfed, their production company or whatever, something entity that controls all of their media. And she said that there's just been delays and delays, and she thinks that this book is just cursed because they've basically had this book finished and then decided to go in a different direction. Like, her and Valentine DeLandro decided that the book needed to go in a different direction in terms of where the story was going. So after, you know, working on issue 5 and getting it mostly done, they decided to scrap it and start from scratch. Whoa. Which is insane.
I was wondering, it's been a while since 4, and I think 4 wasn't even DeLandro. Wasn't 4 like the prequel sort of issue?
No, that was issue 3.
That was 3.
Okay. Yeah, so the rule on that series is going to be every third issue, so 3, 6, 9, 12, so on and so forth, will be a feature.
Origin story.
Yeah, it'll be an origin story about a specific character in the series drawn by someone else. And it's going to still follow the Bitch Planet style, where there's going to be, you know, the story, and then at the end there's going to be an essay by someone, usually a female writer, about, you know, just women issues, I guess. That's not the right way to say that.
Nailed it.
But, you know, just about, like, topics in comics or in society, just all revolving around women. Because, I mean, the whole series is all about noncompliance, this whole idea that there are women in Earth, like at this future dystopian Earth, where you can just be labeled as quote-unquote non-compliant and be sent to jail for simply not abiding by what men tell you to do. And which leads to a whole interesting series of stories in that regard. When they do focus on things on Earth, it's really, really fucked up to see how close they are to actual real-world problems. Mm-hmm. But then they're taken a little step further by saying, okay, well, you decided not to wear... I mean, this is me completely making up something, but, you know, you decided not to wear a dress on your, you know, to your wedding. Okay, you have to go to jail because that didn't comply with what your husband wanted you to do. It's bizarro. It's a bizarro world. But nonetheless, it is very true to life in some ways. Like, the stories always start with something that you could see happening in modern day Western society, and then ultimately end with someone going to jail for something that seems so petty. And yet it is a problem that we still face in today's society. And of course, the main story is all about these women in jail in this place that they call Bitch Planet. And it's got this very, like, old style television show feel. And they talk about it as it being like an exploitation films, you know?
Yeah, it's like a 70s sort of exploitation. Yeah,
there's always this interesting thing about these two guys who are like receivers that take in the new inmates, and them having these conversations back and forth. And it always reminds me of Super Jail or something. Or it reminds me of... And I don't know if you guys have seen Super Jail. Maybe that's a bad reference, but...
My eyes also have been forever scarred by Super Jail.
Yeah, it's a really fucked up Adult Swim show. But it also reminds me of the two guys in the Muppet Show who always sat in the balcony whose names I can't remember.
The ongoing commentary. Yeah.
Yeah, and their commentary about what's happening, and they exist in the story, but they also exist outside of the story in the sense that they are making almost meta-commentary on the book, but not in such a way that they're talking to the viewer. They're just observing what's happening in real time in the book and discussing it, and it kind of gives you an insight as to how this world functions, I guess, like as the jail is administrated, because we don't get to see that. We usually only just see the inside of the jail. Nonetheless, this book is killer, and if you're not reading it, you're doing yourself a disservice, because I think this is one of the most important books being published right now, just because of the just blatant, in-your-face discussion of real-world topics, as well as, this is Valentine Delandro, and you should read anything that he draws. He's one of the most amazing artists out there, and Kelly Sue DeConnick goes without saying, she's a pretty fantastic writer. I don't know, I haven't read, I guess, everything that she's written, but everything that I have written has been pretty good. So that's what's going on for me this week. But Paul and Nick, you guys are reading the same book. Do one of you want to tell us what that book is?
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
But it's probably no surprise to anybody who's listened to more than one episode of this with Nick and I on it, but we both picked Batman number 44. The newest installment of the current super heavy arc. Should we get spoilery about issue 43, Nick? Do you think that
I feel like Batman is a big enough book and it's been long enough that, I mean, maybe we don't have to put all the cards on the table, but I feel pretty okay with the fact that most people that are up to date are up to date on Batman compared to other books. That being said,
I'm not up to date on Batman, but
yeah,
that's okay. Go ahead.
That being said, if you read it in trade, this might be a good time to just stop the podcast. Just stop it. Don't listen anymore.
No. Skip ahead. Just skip ahead. Keep.
You talked about this. It's so much easier. Just
skip ahead. Anyways, talk about this issue, please. Why are you guys excited about Batman 44?
So yeah, this current story arc, the super heavy arc, introduced a new villain, Mr. Bloom, who is sort of preying on the poor people of the Narrows, the neighborhood in Gotham, and offering them superhero abilities, right? So that's kind of the premise that's going on. So Batman, the new Batman, Jim Gordon in a Robotech kind of suit, is hunting down Mr. Bloom, and he asks Bruce Wayne for help. And what we get in issue 43 is sort of a discussion between Alfred and Clark Kent.
Yeah, that was cool.
What?
Who happens to be good close friends with Bruce Wayne.
And he makes Alfred drive him around in a car. He can fly, and instead he makes Alfred drive him around in a car.
Wait, does Alfred know that Clark Kent is Superman?
Oh, he must. He absolutely must.
Clark Kent can't fly. He's just a reporter.
Oh.
Isn't the whole
issue he can't even fly right now anyway? I don't read action except trade.
That's true.
I didn't even think about that.
He's depowered right now. Yeah, that makes sense.
Anyways.
Still makes Alfred drive.
Anyways, they're having a conversation, and the conversation revolves around how different Bruce is since he came back. If you remember, Bruce Wayne appeared to have died, at the end of the Endgame arc. So Clark Kent says, look, I know Bruce Wayne, and that's not Bruce Wayne. His brain patterns are different. His personality is different. He's a different person. He's no longer the person I knew, and we need him. We need Batman. And Alfred says, this is the happiest Bruce has ever been. This is what Bruce Wayne would have grown up to be like had his parents not been killed. And it turns out that Bruce Wayne basically has a type of amnesia. When he came back, he just appeared, and Alfred's daughter found Bruce Wayne's body and basically nursed him back to health, and he's changed. He doesn't remember being Batman. He doesn't remember his parents dying.
What?
He's just like a normal, well-adjusted adult who wants to help the people of Gotham.
Yeah, he's a blank slate. Yeah.
So that's kind of the premise we're dealing with right now. So we have Batman, who's no longer Bruce Wayne, and Bruce Wayne, who's no longer Batman.
Right.
So it's a pretty radical shift, but I think Scott Snyder's done a really good job explaining it all, granted using sort of comic booky science to explain some of it, but it's the furthest anyone's taken this distinction between Batman and Bruce Wayne, even further than Grant Morrison took it in his run. And it's really fascinating. I was blown away by issue 43, and I can't wait for this next one.
Yeah, I really, really loved it because Gordon confronts Bruce, and you can tell Bruce up front is sort of like, look, this isn't my thing. And then Gordon like pushes the hard sell, and then Bruce is like, no, you really don't get it. Like, I am not interested. And you're like, wow, this is kind of a dick. Like, you could at least throw him a bone, geez. And then, of course, you find out that, like, Clark Kent's like, look, it's not just like something's wrong. I've actually freaking scanned his brain, and things are not, what does he say? Like, his neural pathways have been rewritten. And they said it was because of the Dionysium, which, correct me if I'm wrong, that's what Joker was using to appear unkillable, right?
That's right. That's basically the chemical that made the Joker immortal.
Mm-hmm. And it seeps into Endgame arc. It seeps into Bruce's brain and rewrites his brain, jumpstarts it, and brings him back to life, but blank slate.
So Alfred has to tell him what happened, like, oh, your parents were killed, you did this. And just before he reveals the Batcave, Bruce is like, you know, I don't need to know anymore. Like, that's, I can't handle that much pain.
Oh my goodness.
You know, so.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And Clark Kent's like, you know what? Batman will eventually show up if we just put him in the field. And I'm sure this is what a lot of comic book readers were thinking. They're like, you know what? Just put him out there and the instinct will kick in and he'll beat people's asses. And Alfred is like, you don't understand. Like, he doesn't have that, what does he say? He doesn't have that detective ability anymore. He's not trained anymore. If you put him out there, he's actually going to die. And you know, Alfred was, you know, Alfred's pretty upset about it too, but he's like, you know, in the end, Bruce said, you know, I want to help Gotham however I can. And for Alfred, he's like, that's all I ever really wanted. So Scott Snyder, hats off to him. He is, I mean, making Gordon Batman was a great start, but you can tell from this that he is not afraid to just totally put this into a position where it's like, this is not going to be a quick fix. Like, this is not going to be a quick fix. And he pushes it more and more with every issue.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I kind of started reading comics regularly again when Grant Morrison was running Batman, so that's kind of been my anchor, you know, and that's an arc that I really loved. I loved everything that Morrison did with Batman, but Morrison's Batman, this idea was Morrison tried to fix the character, sort of take away the pain so he didn't have to suffer anymore, and Morrison couldn't do it. So his arc, his run on the character ends in a very defeated note. And I like that Scott Snyder's basically said, well, here, I can fix him. And he just kind of does it with this sort of weird sci-fi explanation. Mm-hmm. But it's like, yeah, okay, we'll take the two characters apart. There you go. Batman's no longer Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne's no longer Batman. There, it's all fixed. Obviously, it's not. They're going to have to somehow work this back together in the end. But it's really interesting to see how far both Scott Snyder's going to take it and how far they're letting him take it with this story.
Yeah. Oh, man. And I was really surprised because I honestly thought that if you, and of course you've been, but I mean the reader in general, like if you've been paying attention to Scott Snyder's run, especially that, I think what it was the special oversized Detective Comics 27. If you've been paying attention to his run and the stories he's been telling, there's been this ongoing theory, and I think it also showed up in Future's End, the Future's End one-shot, this idea that Bruce has been secretly working on for a very long time a machine which will basically make Batman after he's gone. Like, he's been working on this project for years and years and years. And so when I heard that Batman was dead, I was like, okay, I get it. Like, we're going to actually see this program take place. And instead, Alfred shows the program to Clark, but that's not what actually happened to Bruce. Seemingly. That's not what actually happened to Bruce. So I thought that was kind of interesting to revisit this idea of a legacy again. And of course, you get these little pictures, pictures all over the page of these weird futuristic Batman visions. Like, I don't know if you saw the one of him in like this tank in the Arctic, like shooting like an oversized Yeti with a mounted cannon on the top of it. What? And I'm just like,
exactly.
I was like, you see that and you're like, oh my gosh, this is, I want that to be a one shot and I want that to be a book. And I don't know. I guess the only other big prying question, and it's a stupid one, but I want to know your opinion, Paul. James Gordon's Batarang gun, is he killing people with that thing? Because it looks like he's killing people with that thing. Like, there are some frame shots where the Batarang's going right between the eyes, and, like, is he still murdering people? I mean, he did before. Well, not murder, but he had no problems with shooting people. I guess that's my point.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, because there were a few frames when he's using that batarang gun where there was, the batarang's like sticking out of the dude's forehead. I'm like, well, that's going to do some damage, whether it kills him or not.
Yeah.
He's lobotomized now.
Batman in general, though.
Well, I mean, yeah.
I mean, Batman hasn't really been killing people, but he's been incapacitating them beyond just the initial fight.
Yeah. He's been making vegetables for years, yes.
Yeah.
That's true.
But, I don't know why that sort of bugged me, but I feel like in the past issues where he's had the Batarang gun, I'm like, that guy's probably not dead. That guy's probably not dead. But in this issue, I was like, I think he just killed that guy.
That's definitely how it looked to me in a few of those panels, so yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. And that's sort of an interesting distinction between Jim Gordon Batman and Bruce Batman and whatever you want to call the police state Batman and normal Batman. And I love that discussion of the police state versus the vigilante Batman came up again. And you have Gordon basically saying, like, vigilante Batman is actually the way this has to be done. And I don't like that this is running through a police state. And he basically talks with his daughter about setting up the bat suit in a way that it uses so little energy that the police aren't actually able to trace and run everything it's doing. And it's such a cool idea because in order to stay under the radar, the suit, most of the suits, doodads and gadgets have to be turned off. And I think Julia Pennyworth says to him at one point, like we've turned off enough at this point that this is really just a costume. Like, at the point we're at, this is just a costume. All this other stuff is not working. Which, I don't know, that's such a cool idea that he's, like, depowered, but he feels like he needs to do it because he feels that the police state is sort of encroaching too much on the role of Batman. I don't know, I thought that was fantastic writing. I thought that was great.
Yeah, you know, I've been kind of critical of Scott Snyder. You know, I've enjoyed his run overall, but a lot of it doesn't work for me at times. But I've liked every issue of this arc. And I like you're pointing out, there's all these little details and subtext going on that make it a lot more fulfilling than any of the previous arcs so far. I'm definitely very excited.
Like 18 billion twists in this. And just when you think you've seen all of it, like they wrap the issue with, minor spoilers, Mr. Bloom turns into this crazy, weird, distorted plant, and he seemingly kills Penguin. And that's the end of the issue. It's like, I didn't think this was going to get any more insane. And then he seemingly murders Penguin. But long story short, that's 43. We're here to talk maybe at least a little bit more about 44.
You have like 2 minutes. You have 2 minutes to talk about 44.
So let's talk about 44. It's going to be an Origins issue. It's going to be, in some ways, a one-shot. It's interesting because Snyder was supposed to work with Azzarello on, what is it, Dark Knight 3, the Master Race? Is that it? I believe Snyder said, look, like, I have to look after the kids because his wife is, like, a doctor. I can't make that many trips into New York City, so I really can't do it, but let's collaborate at some other point. So that's where this whole issue came in. I don't know if they're splitting writing duties or if there's going to be a backstory or not, but apparently it's an origin story. Bruce is Batman again. They hinted in 43 that Mr. Bloom has some further back origins that even Gordon is somewhat privy to, I guess.
Right.
And more importantly, we've got Jock on pencils, and I mean, game over at that point for me. Paul, what do you think about this issue? Do you think it's going to be sort of a throwaway, or do you think?
Well, I'm excited for it because I'm the Mr. Bloom character is fascinating to me. You know, the little bit we've seen so far, especially in that last issue. I'm kind of hoping that Azzarello just does a backup story because I'm not a huge fan of his writing in general.
Same here.
But I think Snyder's, you know, going to do enough of the legwork that it'll be fine. Jock's pencils, I'm never been a big fan of his interior work. For this type of character, this sort of weird, mysterious, moody, horror movie type character that Mr. Bloom seems to be, it might fit really well. So, yeah, I'm very excited to read it.
Well, you know, you guys got in just under 2 minutes. I'm so proud of you right now.
Yeah, yeah.
We're pros.
Yeah. Okay, you know, we're going to take a quick break. Batman sounds so exciting. I say this a million times. I need to read this. I need to read this book. I don't know what I'm doing with my life. I need to just...
Forget those X-Men. Forget those X-Men. Read
Batman. Yeah, okay. Yeah, fuck you. I need to read Batman. That just needs to go. That goes without saying. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how getting into comic books is kind of hard and how recaps are important and how you explain to someone why comic books are great. So we'll be back in a quick second and we'll be talking about that. I give up on time, just like you said you would. There are tiny cracks of light underneath me and you say I got it wrong. But I try hard to uncover them. So on Friday, I was talking to Jeff Perry, who was on this podcast a few weeks back, about, you know, explaining comic books to people and about, like, how he originally got into comics. Or I guess we were just talking about it, about how he originally got into comics. And we kind of thought of this question that he's actually, I think, talking about in his podcast this week. So go listen to After Image. It's pretty great. But we were talking about this idea of how do you explain a comic series to non-comic readers to try to get them to buy it and borrow it or read it or any of those things. And we came up with some interesting ideas, and I didn't actually end up following up with them because I had to go leave to go do something. But I wanted to ask you guys this week, how do you get someone into comics who's not necessarily into comic books initially? Like, someone who's either never read a comic book or scoffs at the idea of comic books. Like, what do you guys do to convince them that they should try something? And how do you go about doing it? Because I know, like, with a lot of comic books, it can be very strange to say, okay, well, you got to read X-Men, you got to do this and this and that. So what do you guys do before I continue to ramble on? Nick, Paul, whoever wants to go first.
Yeah, that's definitely a good question. And sort of it's always one that I've pondered sometimes with certain people that see me reading a comic, and always there's that sort of internal debate of, do I try to convince them to maybe read comics, or is it just a waste of time? Well, yeah. And I mean, yeah, there are people that you sort of just feel like you're going to be hitting your head against a brick wall. Maybe they just don't like reading altogether. They don't really like geek culture at all. They're not really into pop culture. They're not really into literary stuff. I guess it begs the question of what they are into, which who knows what that is, but yeah,
if you skip that idea of, okay, you know people that aren't going to be into reading comics or, you know, all that stuff, but you know someone that you could potentially convince, like, right. How do you go about explaining a certain book without sitting there for 10 minutes explaining to them, well, here's the premise of Nailbiter, you know, like, what do you do to convince someone?
I feel like you have to be a person that's good at explaining or enunciating things, or it certainly helps. Some people can't sell things, you know what I mean? It's like, some people just, it's not going to happen.
I know the feeling.
Yeah, no one will read Demon Knights. And,
well, no, not you, I'm talking about myself, but yeah, sure.
Right, so that definitely helps. And then I think beyond that, it is really, in the words of Randy Jackson, is it Jackson from American Idol? You gotta have the right song choice, dog. I believe those are his words, I think that was his favorite phrase. But the point holds true. You have to know what you want to try to pitch to the person, because if the person isn't really into comics to begin with, or really you think that you're going to have to make a hard sell to begin with, like, you have to pitch the right book. It's super true, and I can definitely speak from experience. My future brother-in-law was visiting with my sister in August, and he saw me reading some comics, and he's like, "Oh, I hear you've got like a, you know, quite a collection." And so I opened up a long box, and I was flipping through some stuff to show him, and he was just really, really shocked at how many of the books. And I mean, this is like a well duh to us, but he was really, really shocked how many of them just weren't superhero books. I mean, he's like, yeah, you know, what's Southern Bastards, and what's Manifest Destiny, and what's Lazarus, and things like this. And it really sparked, you know, something in him, because next thing I know, I'm getting an email 2 weeks later, and he's like, I started looking into the publisher you were talking about, Image, and next thing I know, he's like, I bought Manhattan Projects, Volume 1, and I've been reading that, and do you have any further recommendations? And, yeah, it just boils down to that point of knowing your audience. That's really it, knowing your audience. And then from there, it gets so much easier. So I just went, I know this guy likes politics, I know this guy likes law and social issues, so I was like, Southern Bastards is a fantastic, interesting, complicated, unrepentant portrait of the South, and he said he's loving that. He's probably actually listening to this, believe it or not. Actually started listening to our podcast as well. So yeah, so he's been listening to some of those recommendations, and I think he's probably going to be asking for some more later. But it all starts with knowing your audience, and from there, even practicing the idea of how to pitch a book. Sometimes, like, I mean, I'm serious.
You just,
like,
sitting around, yeah, pacing in your yeah, bedroom, just saying, okay, well, if they really like this kind of book, then I should explain to them that Lazarus is great because of this. But if they don't like it, then the fade out's the one that they want.
Yeah. Just got it all on flashcards. Like, I even go to buildings that are multiple stories so I can literally practice an elevator pitch. So I feel like I'm truly, truly, it's a full-blown simulation. But all joking aside, a lot of times when I'm reading a book, I sort of mentally think to myself, like, how would I explain this book to another person, or how would I pitch this book to another person? Because obviously sometimes, in this segues into last week's thing, how do you read comic books in public? Like, I'm always thinking, you know, if someone comes up and is like, oh, what's that? You know, how can I be a good ambassador for comics and be like, fuck off, lady, go get your own book? No. you know, that I can be a good ambassador and try in two or three sentences to prove that you can read comics and be a well-articulated, thoughtful person that's able to capture the essence of what you're reading. Anyway, that's my little soapbox, but yes.
That's funny. That happened to me once. I was reading comics on the bus, and guy next to me, you know, I was reading them on my Kindle, you know, and he kind of says, oh, I didn't know you could read comics on that. I'm like, oh, yeah, there's all sorts. You can get anything on here. And he's like, well, what kind of comics do you like? And I blanked. I'm like, I don't know how to answer that question. like, what
is,
kind of comics? I'm like, I like
really
them all.
That's a really hard question to answer sometimes when you're...
So,
when you read a lot of comics,
it's a very open-ended question. It's a very
exactly.
Question.
And
you just turn to them and you say, "That's kind of a big question."
No, I actually came up with an even worse answer. I thought about it for a second, and I just go, Batman, and that was literally my answer. Like, what kind of comics do you like? I go, Batman,
and you rolled your
true.
Eyes and went back to your
I was
comic
like, oh,
book.
Fuck, why did I say that?
Gives you the that's what I thought phase.
Yeah, but I mean, that's kind of leads, you know, that's part of a bigger issue, is that I think for most people, when they think comic books, they think superheroes. I mean, that's the genre,
absolutely,
for better or for worse, that's been associated with the medium for so long. And that's when I recommend comics to people, I tend to recommend, like, original graphic novels, standalone books, and not series so much. I want to hand them, like, a one-volume thing, like, here, read this and enjoy this. I've recommended Black Hole, the Charles Burns book, to about a dozen different people, and they've all liked it.
Yeah.
You know, something about a standalone story you can enjoy in one sitting. I think that's really appealing to people, and it also is a book that's about as far from superheroes as you can get.
yeah.
But the thing, especially with that book in particular, and a lot of the stuff I try to recommend to people, appealing to the visuals, the artwork, is kind of a good way to do it. Or the tone of the book. Black Hole, I always kind of pitch as being a sort of, you know, Twin Peaks era David Lynch meets David Cronenberg body horror kind of stuff. And I mean, appealing to movies is always, it's weird because you don't want to say, oh, it's just like this movie that you like. But because they're both visual mediums, it's easy to say, like, oh, this reminds me of the tone or the look of Twin Peaks or David Lynch or David Cronenberg. That's why you should check it out. And if you like that stuff, you might dig this because it's a similar tone, just from a different medium.
Yeah, and it like Paul was getting at, I think it sort of puts you in this uncomfortable position where the easiest thing to do is, well, it's like this meets this, or it's like that and that. And it's like, you know, if you're like a liberal arts purist snob, you're like, well, why do you want to, you know, how unfair to try to make equivalencies between things? There's no one thing is truly just like another thing, so don't do that.
Right.
But ultimately, that is how people are used. That is how people are used to being sold things. It's as
well,
much as I don't
comic
love
books
it.
Anyways.
That's the route to take. Oh yeah, comic books loves that idea. You know, if something isn't meeting something else, it's not a comic.
unfortunately,
Yeah.
See, the thing is, I think we run into a problem, and I'm just hijacking this topic.
No, that's
I'm
fine.
Sorry, Nick. We run into this problem, I think, a lot. To go back to your point, Paul, about recommending OGNs to people, I think a lot of the times for me, I think I struggle with, I want to recommend someone a book that I just started reading because I'm really excited about it.
Right,
so someone will say, hey, you should read, you know, they'll say, well, what should I read? And I go, well, I just started reading Invisible Republic and it's 3 issues in, so you should probably wait 3 months and then start getting into comic books when the trade comes out.
Right.
You know, because the last thing you want to do in a lot of cases is give someone like a serialized book and you run into this issue that, you know, Nick, we've talked about this before, but when you recommended The Fade Out to your dad and he was like, oh, that's it? There's only 6 issues out or there's only the trade out? And so you don't want to get them to a point where a story is continuing and they have to wait for more.
Right.
And a month to new comic book readers is an unfathomable amount of time to wait for new content. Where, you know, we recognize that that's status quo. That's what we expect. So recommending OGNs is always great, but it's something that you always forget about because when you read an OGN, it's one and done, and it's not on the top of your mind. Whereas a book that you're reading consistently every week, even if you're 30, 40 issues in, if you were going to recommend Batman to someone, you would say, okay, well, you got to start back at trade one and just ignore some other stuff where people say that it crosses over this other thing. Just keep reading this one book. And then you've gotten yourself into this tangled web of, oh, shit, I said crosses over with another thing, and I recommended, I said this other book, and now they're going to think they need to read both. And you've already, for me, this is where it becomes a problem, where I've opened up this can of worms where I have to explain how comic books are really fucked up and how they don't work a lot.
Sit down.
And
your mother and I are going to have a talk.
One consistent story. And if you want to just read one consistent story, you have to just be diligent and just ignore all the peripheral stuff that says, hey, read this thing, hey, read that thing, and just stick to the one story. I just wanted to add that little bit there. Sorry, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I think that's why books like Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen are so popular is because you can read them in one sitting. They stand alone. You don't have to have all that background. The books have more meaning if you have a background in comics. If you know more about Batman, you could appreciate Dark Knight Returns more, but you don't need to know that. I mean, I guess that's why people like Hush so much, even though it's a terrible comic. It's got every... If someone doesn't want to read a Batman comic monthly...
Just bring this back. Like, this is good.
If someone doesn't want to read Batman month to month, but they want to see all of the villains that they know are out there, Hush is a perfectly fine book. They get every character they'd ever want to see, and they don't ever have to read another Batman book to get them. Set aside the fact that I don't think it's a very good story, but that's the appeal of it. It's like I know that these characters exist, and I know that they're out there. I don't want to invest too much time. I just want to read a story that has them in it.
Man,
there's something
I totally
to be said for
disagree
that,
with you
know.
Guys about Hush. This is ridiculous. I actually like Hush, and I think that's a big debate that we could have another day. But but getting back to the point, it's like when you run into this issue of explaining comics to people. I mean, how do you keep yourself so succinct? I guess. I mean, I'm awful at this, so I can't really say that I know how to do this well. Somehow, I managed to convince Jeff Perry to read Nailbiter, and I think that all I said was serial killers in Oregon, and there's something in the water, but no one really knows what it is. And he was like, "Okay, I'm hooked." And then I kept talking, but he had already picked up the trade and walked away.
He was gone. So,
but I think you guys, I think, probably do a much better job at being more succinct. So I guess, how do you boil down like the premise of a comic without opening up Wikipedia and just reading the premise off of that?
Oh, right. Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between what someone might find appealing about the book and what the story actually is. Because if you're just telling someone what the story of the comic is, well, why would they read it? You know, you've already told them what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I always kind of appeal to like the tone of something that I know someone likes. If there's a movie that they like or another form of literature or something that they dig or maybe a creator they're sort of familiar with, appeal to that. Rather than appealing to the nuts and bolts of the story itself.
Right.
And like I also said, I think artwork has a lot to do with that. If you show someone a comic and they're expecting to see, you know, a superhero comic, but then they see a unique art like Jaime Hernandez or Charles Burns, that's going to stand out and that's going to be a bigger hook than maybe you could explain the story as. Mm-hmm. I mean, because for me, art is what carries a comic. Good art can make up for a bad story. So if you can appeal to that rather than just, you know, the story itself, maybe that's the way to do it.
Yeah. Nick, do you follow the same kind of guidelines for that then?
Yeah. I mean, Paul's kind of opened up an interesting can of worms and the whole question of what can truly carry a comic when the other elements are lacking. And I think when you're dealing with new readers, I think the predisposition there is they're not of a mindset that I think most of the time they're really willing to put up with crappy art. If the writing is great, I think the reverse is very true for new readers. I think glossy, interesting art will save the day when the writing is average. But it's definitely a fine line because you want to show people art that is not what they expect, but not so weird that they're like, whoa, 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 I can't do this. But also art that
isn't... And by weird, do you mean like, when you say weird, do you mean like abstract?
Sure. So here's a good example.
Poorly drawn, because I think there's a definite difference.
Right. And there obviously is a huge difference between art that is out there and art that is not technically proficient. And I think that's probably what you're getting at. For example, for if I was suggesting a book to someone, I think it would be very tough, and this is someone we discussed earlier, I think it would be very tough to sell people on Frank Quietly. Honestly, I think that would be true. Yeah. What I think would be a good example of art that is that subverts the norm of superhero comics, but is not totally out there, like Cliff Chiang would be a perfect example for me of someone who definitely draws, or Raphael Albuquerque is another person that draws in a very distinctive, interesting, evocative style that is neither totally out of left field or crappy, but also not too far removed from, to some extent, what people expect.
Yeah, I could agree with that. Yeah.
You know, well, Frank Quietly, though, because I've recommended...
All-Star
I've
Superman, recommended, probably.
I've recommended also, but I've recommended We Three to a lot of people as kind of a entry point to comics. And although I always sell that book as saying, well, the last page of the book made me cry. So it's like a personal appeal. Like, it's a really good story, and it's so moving that for some reason, I don't even own pets, but this book made me cry, you know? Mm-hmm. If you've read We Three, you'll kind of see why, I guess, but...
Everyone should read We Three. It's a pretty fantastic book.
Exactly.
Everyone read this
trying
book
to
but
sell
me?
It.
My goodness. Jordan will not shut up
about
this book.
You. Yeah. It's just you, Nick. See? You're the only person.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's part of the appeal. Or maybe that's what makes comics difficult for people to get into, is knowing almost how to read them. Mm-hmm. In a weird way, as strange as that sounds, you know, because I've had that experience too, where I've been telling someone why I like comics and getting into a little bit of theory, because I'm always fascinated in comic book theory, and handing them a book, and one of the first comments is like, "Well, how long do I look at each panel?" I'm like, "Well, if you're asking that question, that's going to be an uphill battle for you to appreciate the art form. It's just it seems to be something intuitive." So it's
sort of like someone in an art gallery and they're staring at one of the paintings and they're like, "How long do I have to be here?"
Like, how long do I have to look at it? Exactly.
That's how I feel at the art at an art museum.
Yeah, me too.
what's considered like the okay amount? Like, not too long, but not too short. You know,
at which point do I feel
when
culturally
can I pull up my
saturated?
Phone? Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I think that example I just gave, I would think I was recommending a Daniel Klaus book, and I think it was Ghost World, and I was recommending it because this person had seen the movie, and that's another thing. There's so many movies that are at least based on comics. That's a good hook, too. Like, hey, if you liked Ghost World, did you know it was based on a comic? Because, unfortunately, the term comic book movie is synonymous with superhero movies. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of great movies that are based on comics that people don't realize are based on
Absolutely
comics.
Absolutely no idea.
I think Ghost World is probably best example of that. And Daniel Klaus's stuff is so unique that I think someone who liked that movie is going to click with his style and his humor in his books and, you know, hopefully enjoy them.
Yeah, and how many times is it true that the graphic novel or the comic is actually massively better? Because I feel like it's so true so much of the time. Like Robert Venditti's, what is that book? Now I'm blanking. It's the Bruce Willis movie with this, is it Surrogates? Yes. And I think the book was called The Surrogates.
Oh, The Surrogates,
That's a perfect example of a movie that I think nobody has any idea that it's actually based on a comic. And the comic is...
Well, it's like that in The Losers. I mean, there's easily like a couple dozen movies that are out there that are based on comic books. And I think ultimately the reason why we think the comic books are better is because they don't have that like movie requirement to like be representative or be every man or be, you know, simplistic enough. Or like in comic books, there can be very convoluted plots that get wrapped up in 12 issues, and you can't turn that into a movie. Like a six-issue comic book probably works much better as a movie than, say, a 12-issue comic book, just because the amount of, or the density of that book is so much greater in 12 issues. So when you try to, you know, exploit that out into a movie that has to fit under 2 hours and more likely going to be around an hour and a half to an hour 45, it just doesn't do the book justice. That's a little bit away from what we were talking about, but anyways, to you, anyways, Nick, sorry.
I don't know. It's always tricky trying to convince people of things, especially when there isn't sort of an analog to compare it to, and you're just sort of having to, as briefly as you can, just being super mindful that you can't trail on for too long, or you realize that you probably have about 8 seconds before their brain, you know, drifts off to something else. Just sort of sell it to them. And another really interesting book that sort of worked for me and kind of gets at this idea of how do you read comics, or how do you expand people's minds to really, really be open to just how many different art styles there are out there. The guy that I convinced to read Manhattan Projects, or I guess he started that on his own, but before that I actually had him read some of Batman Black and White, which was a really, I don't know if most people would tell me that was a bright idea, but I thought that was a really good opener to this idea that, you know, comics can look like this and still be about the very same subject matter as someone drawing like this, and you can tell all these different stories in different ways, and of course they're all standalone, and I thought that was another a pretty good thing to sell people on. But I don't know if this is too much of a tangent, but I wanted to go back to another point you had talked about earlier, Mike, and you were saying that it's one of the things you want to be mindful of is you don't want to put people in a situation where if the book you recommend or the book they're interested in, it might be a great fit for them. They might be very interested, but you don't want to put them in a position where it's 4 issues or maybe it's 10 issues and that's it, and then they have to come back to you for another recommendation. You want to try to be mindful and set them up with something that if they're driven or if they're interested in, there's a good amount of subject material to go through. Mm-hmm. But the catch-22 there is, as you were saying, pretty soon you're dealing with crossovers, or maybe the trade they're reading doesn't include the annual that they're supposed to switch to. And I will say this, I think DC and Marvel have done a very good job that if you are strictly reading the trades these days, your ass will be covered in every situation. Like, they will make sure you get all of the stuff you're supposed to read. But yeah, it puts you in this kind of problematic situation where you want to give them a large amount of back matter, but with a large amount of back matter comes other problems.
Yeah, and I think to your point of Marvel and DC doing a pretty good job of covering you in that regard, I think they do a really good job at recommending what to read next. In a lot of cases, they'll say, hey, you just finished Volume 4 of Ultimate Spider-Man, you should read Volume 5. Also in this same universe or related books are Ultimate Fantastic Four Volume 1 and Ultimate, you know, X-Men Volume 1. And I only give those just because they're kind of in a contained universe, but I know that when I was reading those books in trade, I never felt like I needed to hunt for the next thing. I just had it there for me. Like, Marvel was recommending it for me, or it seemed like a natural carryover to say, okay, once you finished all of this book, you can also read this because they're semi-related, or at some point, characters from this other book showed up in the book that you're currently reading. And I think when it comes to big two recommendations, for the last probably 10 or 12 years, things have gotten a little bit better in terms of, like, recommending what should be next already in the book, or your comic book shop or wherever you buy it for, even Barnes & Noble will have, you know, the next 8 volumes, or they'll have books that are semi-related kind of bunched together. But that's, I mean, when it comes to big two, I mean, that's a whole different animal in itself, and I think a lot of the times we end up just saying, don't try reading big two. Try reading this other thing if you're going to get into comics, and if you want to read something about the big two, then after that we can talk, or you can try to figure it out on your own, because getting someone into an indie book is a hell of a lot easier because there's no strings attached. There's just the book, you know. And we've said this a million quadrillion times on this podcast, but I think that's the best, in my opinion, I think that's the best way to get someone started. And especially with going to that graphic novel idea that you were talking about, Paul, like, even then, that's like a great way to say, here's a basis of what comic books are, and then going from there saying, okay, well, now that if you like that, or you're willing to try a little more, here's this other thing that you could go read at the library, or I could lend to you. And when it comes down to lending someone comics, that's even like the best place to be, because then you can feed a person books in a certain order and say, read this and then read that. Whereas at a comic shop or at Barnes & Noble or wherever you buy your books, it might not be so obvious. Like, Amazon's recommendations are really bizarre. And you say, you know, you buy volume 1 of Runaways, you might also like volume 9 of Miss Marvel. And it's like, what? How are those two even related? But someone may buy them not knowing that they aren't related in that regard. So we, you know, explaining comic books to people is, you know, is always tough. It's just, I guess the point here is be succinct and don't drabble on for forever. Just say, here's a good comic book, match the genre, and go from there, I guess. Or match the genre that they like.
So we've certainly spent a good amount of time on this podcast and podcasts in the past talking about the idea of how do you get people reading comics? What do you convince them to start reading first? What's a good starter book?
We literally just talked about that.
We just talked about that.
So if you're someone who's jumping around the podcast and you're feeling left out, you need to actually go back and listen to the whole thing. There's a reason for that.
If you skipped from the Batman thing earlier and got this far ahead, you need to go back.
Yeah, you've gone too far, and I told you to actually stop instead of, you know, jumping over. So you clearly aren't following instructions, so just go back to the beginning and listen to the whole thing up until this point. I'll give you a second.
Nick, continue, please.
All right, at this point, you're caught up.
I'm losing my shit over here. Oh my god. Every time you tell people to just stop listening to the podcast, I'm just,
I know,
like,
right?
Stop saying that.
It's really only one click away, guys. It's real simple. So yeah, everyone wants to discuss how to start reading comics, what to read first, and it's not something you're just gonna see here. It's all over the internet. But someone on Reddit sort of briefly got at this point, and I think it's a valid discussion point as well, and that is when you start reading comics, especially if maybe someone isn't holding your hand or you just randomly pick up an issue of, I don't know, Cable and the X-Force,
X-Force.
Is that a thing?
Sure,
yeah. So you just randomly pick up an issue of that, and you're like, well, I recognize this guy, and I recognize this guy, and I read the summary at the beginning, so I kind of feel like I'm sort of following along, but I need more details. I need to understand, like, where does this fit into a bigger picture, things like that. What sort of resources are out there? Where do you go? What sort of information and places should I be seeking this stuff from? And I thought that was a great question, because I think we've all been there.
Yeah, I mean, with Cable and X-Force, I can tell you that there is a lot of minutiae to that book, and quite honestly, if you're going to start at issue 7, you should go back and read X-Force from the 90s, because really, no, I'm not going to answer that question. No, I think there, yeah, Nick, your point of where do you get your information from, especially if you jump into a book at a quote-unquote jumping on point, and this is specific around like Big Two, I think if you're jumping into an independent book, there's probably a lot that you should go back and read, especially say you jump into Invincible, which is like 100 and some issues in, that I think is very risky, like, or scary, not risky, but it's very scary because you jump in and there's a lot of implied history. And a lot of these books, I mean, Invincible, anywhere at Marvel, they'll say, this is a jumping on point for new readers. And usually what they'll do is they'll give some summary. Like, for instance, mm-hmm. Invincible, when they really released this big new number one thing where it was like the new number one for Invincible and they wanted to tell readers, literally, you can jump on at this point. And instead of doing, like, a summary. No, and this is the funniest thing in the
entire
world.
And at this point, the book was in triple digits, right? And they said, this is a good jumping on point.
Yeah, the book is in triple digits and they say this is a good jumping on point. And hilariously, we talked about this when the issue came out. So if you listen to that episode, we've already discussed this. But nonetheless, they spent the first four pages of that comic going through the important historical moments of that book and redrawing and retelling the story in captions and bubbles just to say, hey guys, we realize that there's a lot of backstory to this book, but we want to catch you up so you can start reading from right here. And I think that is the most noble effort a comic book has ever made into saying, here's a perfect jumping on point 100 and X issues in. Like, that is a fantastic way to just say, fuck buying all of our books. Just start reading right here, man, because that's really cool of you. So
explains why DC never does that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the funny thing. You know, we talk about, you know, Cable and X-Force was a book that you used as an example, but Marvel, I think, does a really good job of putting little synopsises before each of their books to say, here's what happened last issue and in previous issues that's going to be relevant information for this issue, and then the story starts. And I don't know who writes that. I don't know if it's the editor or if it's the writer themselves. I think Matt Fraction at one point said that their editor was writing all of the sum-ups for Hawkeye. Not like that book needed it. It was so short, everyone was rereading it a million times over and over as each issue came out every 6 months. But nonetheless, you know.
Burn!
But to get to the actual point here and stop making jokes and being an asshole, when you're getting into comic books, I know for me, I guess my experience was I wanted to read X-Men. I knew I love X-Men, you know, before I started reading comic books, and I wanted to start reading X-Men. So I bought a volume, and I got really confused. I bought, like, a volume one at Barnes & Noble thinking, this is a good jumping on point. It was not a good jumping on point because it was Grant Morrison's new X-Men. And I thought, no. Oh, this sounds great. It's Grant Morrison, or I don't know who Grant Morrison is at the time. It's new X-Men, right? Those two words sound great together. And it's a volume one. What does that mean? So I read the book and I was like, all right, this kind of makes sense. This doesn't make sense. I'm going to buy other comic books that seem to be have come out in the last like 6 months and think that maybe if those X-Men books are somehow tied to this one, I'm just going to, you know, get all this information and now volume one will make sense. Now that didn't work. And I bought a bunch of random X-Men books and instead just said, okay, screw it. It's 2005. I'm going to jump on this new fangled Wikipedia thing and just start I don't think that was actually brand new, but it was new to me because I just got high-speed internet. But anyways, I just got high-speed internet and I was like, yeah, so I would sit on Wikipedia and I'd just read character bio after character bio and history and like story arcs and oh, there's more X-Men. This volume one isn't actually volume one because it starts at issue number 112 and there were 100 issues that happened before that. Should I read all of those? And then I'd go to a bunch of various forums that were talking about it. And I said, the ultimate discussion was don't read all the backstory, just read the Wikipedia entries about all of those stories. That'll give you the gist. That'll give you the plot points that you need to make this new volume make sense. Now, what do you do nowadays? I don't know. I mean, in the old age of 10 years ago in 2005, I think I was very fortunate that there wasn't this humongous, weird universe like spanning everything that was going on up until about House of M in 2008. But like, so you could read just one X-Men storyline and it all made sense. And like characters would jump in between, but then the editor's notes or the synopsis is the beginning of the trades or at the beginning of the issues probably, because I wasn't buying single issues at the time, were enough explanation to say, well, Storm just came from a big fight in Extreme X-Men and now she's here to help Nightcrawler do this other thing. And you're like, okay, cool, Nightcrawler, X-Storm, I know who all these characters are, I watch the TV shows and all that. So like I hooked into a bunch of like nostalgia factors to say I knew who these characters were, so I had enough backstory to say, well, I guess Storm would do that, I guess Jean Grey would do that, I guess Professor X would do that. And then you just rolled with the punches, and if I didn't understand something, I learned that eventually what I'll just have to go do is go read other books or read Wikipedia entries. And then I discovered UncannyXMen.net, and and then I read a whole bunch of plot synopses for individual issues,
and then wrote a bunch of plot synopses for a whole bunch of other issues.
Well, that was my own secret fan fiction website, Nick. What was interesting is that I would read these things during class. Like I would print them out and read them instead of paying attention in class. Like it was awful. I was an awful high school student my senior year. But it was just a lot of reading and catching up on my own because I was just genuinely interested and I was like obsessed with trying to catch up on the X-Men. And now nowadays, if I pick up a new book, I have no idea what's going on. I just roll with the punches. Like Martian Manhunter right now, reading that book. And, like, weird shit's happening in that book with the character Martian Manhunter. But then, like, there's all these implied things happening with the JLA. And I'm like, what the fuck? Why are the JLA in this book? How are they even related? Like, Superman's genuinely concerned about Martian Manhunter. And I'm like, are they like buddies or something? I don't understand why. Like, I know that they're in the Justice League together, but like, do those guys actually care about each other? I thought it was more like going to work and like you don't really like your coworkers, but you're nice to them.
Do those two guys actually care about each other?
Do they actually care about each other?
You can put
the Justice League is just like a job. You just clock in at the clock tower, at the watchtower, right? And clock out when your shift's done. And
yeah, so I have no idea. And I just roll with it because I know that that's not important to the story. The story that's important is happening to Martian Manhunter. And, you know, if you care about those peripheral things, then, yeah, you should go do your research and figure out how they tie in. Check forums and check Wikipedia entries. But, like, nowadays, I just don't give a shit. But I think that's just because I've become complacent.
Yeah. I mean, I had a very similar experience because, you know, I read comics when I was a teenager. And, you know, I kind of stopped after high school and when I was in college. But when I got back into reading comics again, it had been, you know, 7-8 years since I was reading regular monthly superhero comics. The first things I picked up were Grant Morrison's Batman, which was about halfway through. It was right when the RAP arc started, and Final Crisis.
Oh man, that's a weird time to start reading comic books.
What a great yeah, exactly. What a great time and place to. Oh man.
And well, the thing is, like, I was always a big DC fan, so I recognized most of the characters and can be like, all right, that's that guy and that's that person. And I kind of know their backstory. At least I knew what it was 10 years ago. But yeah, like you said, Wikipedia kind of became my go-to. And it's like, well, I don't know who – that's a different, you know, character wearing this familiar-looking costume. I wonder who that is. And it's just a matter of doing the research. And that's how I kind of treated it, was doing research. You know, I was invested in the story, and I was invested in getting caught up. So it was like doing – I don't want to say it was work because it was enjoyable, but it was like kind of like a job, kind of putting in the research. But
yeah. I mean, do you still do that nowadays, though? I mean, like, I find myself, if I'm reading something, like, Forever Evil, I read that, and I was like, who the fuck's that guy? And I just Wikipedia'd it, and I was like, okay, that's someone that used to be Booster Gold, and then I just kept going, so.
Well, it depends. I mean, a lot of stuff I can kind of just intuit, you know, having enough familiarity with the big two, at least, and those characters. If I'm picking up something like an X-Men book, I gotta do some research, because I have no idea who half those characters are. Then once I'm about halfway through the Wikipedia entry, my eyes glaze over and I fall asleep.
Yeah.
But oddly, the only X-Men story I generally enjoyed was Grant Morrison's, and I had no fucking clue what was going on. I just liked the way it was written so much. But anyway.
And that story's so... Okay, I'm not going
to... We'll have that fight a different week.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but these days, I tailor my pull list enough where it's books and characters I'm familiar with enough where I don't feel like I need to do that much research.
And it's also probably like new number ones from indie publishers. So you don't have to, like, you're getting in on the ground floor.
Yeah, exactly. And even if I'm going back and reading older stuff, which I like to do, it's old random back issues I pick up. I'm always surprised how many more editorial notes there used to be in comics, especially in the 70s and 80s. If there's a character that wasn't normally appearing in the book, they would tell you who it was. Or if something happened, be like, hey, be sure to check out Amazing Spider-Man number 247 to get the rest of that story. You don't see that as much in comics these days. It's almost like assumed that people will know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, probably it's something where they don't want to clutter the page either, because like they'll throw characters in at a whim. You know, 15 editor's notes on one page is a little cumbersome.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but if it's something that I'm invested in, like, I don't mind going back and reading a bunch of stuff. Like when I started reading Love and Rockets, which is, I mean, being published continuously for 30 years now, I had no problem just going back and starting from the beginning. You know, that wasn't an issue. I enjoyed reading it so much. It's weird to think that's different from superhero comics, but it's really not. A lot of the superheroes have been around for at least 30 years, and Love and Rockets is different because those characters haven't been rebooted at all.
Well, same thing with Judge. I think that's like an exception because to the rule of like indie comics. Like there aren't that many indie comics that have been published that long. Let's just be honest here.
And then, you know, another recent example is I started reading Judge Dredd. Again, a character that's been around for almost 40 years and has never been rebooted. And there's kind of like John Wagner has been writing most of the major Judge Dredd stories for the past almost 40 years. It's kind of like almost one creator shaping the universe, and it's so dense and self-referential, it's hard to jump into it. Luckily enough, I found, you know, a blog someone was writing. Douglas Walk was writing his Dredd Reckoning blog, where he would go through every single Dredd story. So finding a resource like that, just stumbling across that, doing a little bit of internet searching and finding a resource like that made getting to Judge Dredd a lot easier. The problem is it's not readily available. You kind of have to do the research and the legwork yourself to find that stuff.
Yeah, totally. And so, Nick, I'm really interested to hear your research techniques, because you are probably one of the most diligent researching type people that will. I mean, and that's not an insult. Like, quite honestly, that it's commendable how much research and work and effort you put into your comics. So, I really want to hear your process. Now that you've heard how Paul and I just lazily read Wikipedia and blog entries, just like, well, right. whatever, and just move on. Yeah, I really want to hear about your note taking efforts and craziness that goes into your comic reading experience.
Yeah, no, I think what's really sort of bizarre about the whole thing to begin with is that. Most of the people that are having to do this research that feel that they need to, it's always big too, because they recognize characters, or they're like, oh, I know who Batman is, or oh, I know who Green Lantern is, and yet then they get into it because it looks familiar, and then there's a sort of unfamiliar side to things as well. So they'll be like, oh, I know who Green Lantern is, and then they open it up, and then there's someone different as Green Lantern, and it's like, well. It's just interesting that something is so at the same time familiar and unfamiliar to a person. And as you mentioned, Wikipedia, like right off the bat, is actually not that bad.
Totally.
Depending upon the subject matter, depending upon the character, Wikipedia is actually pretty dang good. And obviously because canon and things change so much with comics. The idea that Wikipedia can be corrected and changed and altered so frequently really allows for things to actually show up or be presented in a correct fashion. Because if you're not at Wikipedia, the next stop you're probably going to end up at is either the DC Wikia or the Marvel Wikia. But the problem with Wikias is that first, there's ads all over the frickin' place, and they're really obnoxious. And then the second thing is that they aren't kept up as well as you would think. I'm honestly surprised when you think about the people that are really, really into comics and really dedicated and really nitpicky about one detail or another, you would be shocked to see sort of the sad state of the Wikias of the big two. I would say DC's is actually worse. So at that point, maybe you're wondering, what's this weird character, or who's this artist, or things like that. And from there, I usually end up a lot of the time at comicbookdb.com, short for Comic Book Database. And that site is fantastic, because you can literally get all of the details for any individual issue, or what I use it for a lot is... Well, this writer name, the name of this writer looks familiar, or the name of this artist looks familiar. I've definitely seen it before. Like, where was that? You can look up artists or writers, and it'll give you a full profile breakdown chronologically or alphabetically of what they've worked on and what roles they've had. And that site does wonders. Comic Vine kind of does the same thing, but I feel it doesn't do as good of a job.
No, well, Comic Vine Comic Vine and Comic Book DB, those are both like user submitted, like websites where the content doesn't come from the publishers, whether it's indie or big two or anything like that. It's all user submitted information. So I mean, there's still that variable like Wikipedia worry where like something might not be incorrect or something might not be updated yet. Especially because I remember I used to use Comic Book DB pretty religiously for about a year and a half, and I ran into this issue where like on Wednesdays or even Thursdays on the week, like they wouldn't have the most up-to-date information about things. So when I'm reading my comic book on Wednesday, I'm like, well, who is this writer? What did they do? And they just hadn't cited the author yet. And I'm like, this is basic. Why isn't it this link in there? And I mean, I could have probably done the work and actually submitted it myself, but I mean, I'm here to take this free content for me and not contribute right, in any way,
right.
Please.
You're the consumer, not the contributor. Right. Yeah, exactly.
But it's still all user-submitted stuff. But nonetheless, I think it is moderated and cleaned up much better in some regards.
Yeah, and if you are ever a little bit anxious about that, you can usually Google, at least with DC, you can Google an issue, and DC will have a dedicated page for that issue,
yeah.
Which is not to say those have been wrong. I've definitely seen a couple where the art is wrong or the mm-hmm. something's wrong in it, which I guess makes it hard to recommend at that point, but yeah. I guess it's there.
Well, I mean,
guess
that's
worth something.
That's a technology problem, I think. That's just like keeping your content up to date, and that mm-hmm. that doesn't change between any publisher. Image, Marvel, Dark Horse, Boom, everybody does that in some regards. Like their content may just be off and not working or appearing properly.
Right. Right.
But yeah, so there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot that goes into this, like in terms of research, which makes like getting into comics, like from our previous topic, seem incredibly daunting, right? But uh-huh. I think for the three of us, it's an example of, you know, if you really really want to get into it, you have the potential to work really hard to do this stuff. Like if you really want to know everything, it's not something that's going to be easy. But obviously when you've got 30 years, 40, 50, 60 years worth of history in your comics, especially when it comes to the big two, like there is a lot to know. And you'll never know when a writer or a creator in any regard wants to just bring in a random character. Like I was saying earlier with Secret Wars, like Molecule Man just became a big player in Secret Wars. And I don't know where Molecule Man came from. I don't know. I think he's an Avengers bad guy, or at least he was at some point. And so him being pulled out of the ether for this series totally makes no sense to me, but I rolled with it because they did a pretty decent explanation of who he was in the book. And really, if I wanted to know more, I would just go to Wikipedia. Like we said, like if you really want to know something, you can easily just go to Wikipedia. And if you want to go the next step, you can go even further to find out histories about characters, about various books, about, you know, the origins of publishers, all this stuff that I'm sure all three of us have probably looked up at some point. When did Marvel switch from Timely Comics to Marvel? What's the big deal with Stanley and Jack Kirby? I mean, it's all on Wikipedia, and luckily we live in the internet era where you can just get anything on the internet. So there's a plethora of information, but of course you always should take it with a grain of salt because it is the internet. So you never know if something's going to be right, and you're like, I didn't know that Sue Storm was the child of Reed Richards. You're like, that's not right. That's not correct. They're married. They are not father-daughter.
This is really gross.
Why am I on www.xxxfantasticfour.net? What is happening? You know, so Google with I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. It's the internet, you know, people.
I've been to that site. You do know what you're talking about. You do.
It's interesting because, I mean, that history can be daunting, but I think, like you were kind of hinting at, Mike, that history is what makes comics exciting for readers like us. I mean, that's the reason I liked superheroes when I was a kid, is because it reminded me of mythology. There was so much more. There was always more to learn. There was always more background to the characters because mm-hmm. they've been around for so long. But not that. I mean, comics are still a relatively young medium. So we can actually go back and look at how they began, which is, again, is kind of exciting. So yeah. The history should never be daunting. The history is what makes reading comics fun, at least for me.
It adds more color to what comic books are, because it's not just the issue that came out this week. It could potentially be, you know, 10 years worth of history on a book. Like, you look at something like Hellboy, even, for instance. I mean, that's a pretty long-running series. I mean, not just Hellboy, but the Hellboy universe, BPRD, and all the millions of little mini-stories. There's so much to that universe. But for some reason, I feel like I never have to tell anybody, if you're going to read Hellboy, you should start with Volume 1 or you should do your research. Because Hellboy is one of those beautiful books that it's like, all you need to know is the concept of Hellboy. And you can start reading that book. And that, mm-hmm. that's a wonderful thing. I think I'm not even going to try to say his name because I fucked it up last week and whatever. But like all the creators that have worked on those books in the Hellboy universe, like they must go into it with a mindset of, we're just writing another story that participates in this universe, and you don't need to give the origins of anybody. And if you do, so be it. Like I can't say I've read enough Hellboy to know if they do this every issue where they introduce all the characters, but I feel like there's definitely enough in those books in their little recap pages or any kind of recap, even the synopsis on the back, that gives you enough to start the book and read it from start to finish without any questions. And anything after that is just, you know, read more BPRD, read this Abe Sapien one shot, read this, you know, little 4-issue miniseries about the guy with the skull and a thing. I don't know all the characters of Hellboy. This is a terrible example. but you guys get what I'm saying? Like, I think that some publishers do a really good job of crafting their stories so that you don't need to do that research, but they give you the option and say, hey, if you want to, it's fine, or just read the rest of our books and you'll get a broader picture.
Right. Yeah, and I think you're completely right. I think, and unfortunately this decision can't be made without some knowledge of publishers on the whole, but I think if you know you're in a situation where you can sort of afford to roll with the punches, why not? I mean, honestly, sometimes it's just nice to be like, I don't know who this guy is, but eventually this will eventually sort itself out.
Right.
They'll explain it, or they'll cover it, or if it's not that important, it will not be brought up. And like I said, I think that that's a good mindset to have, but you also have to understand that certain publishers do not operate that way. I think like you said, Dark Horse, and I think also to some degree Marvel, is very aware of, you know, people jumping on at various points or wanting to recap things. And on the flip side, I would say DC is not as conscientious of that. They're just like, hey, you're here, so let's get down to business, and either you get things or you don't. Because they don't do a synopsis page. I wish they did.
Nah.
But that isn't them. So, but otherwise, yeah. I, as much as I like doing my research and learning about one character or another, or, well, you know, this new guy is Blue Beetle, but I could swear he wasn't always Blue Beetle. What's going on there? I think there's also a certain amount of joy, and it really reminds me of back when I just started reading comics of, well, you know what? I don't really understand all the bits and pieces, but I know who that guy is, and I know who that guy is. That's a pretty good start. They'll hopefully fill in the rest for me. Sometimes it's just nice to not have to go grab the computer, on occasion, you know, grab the computer and start taking notes and map out, you know, all of the different power sets of some stupid character. So, which when you're dealing with Batman is nice, because you don't have to worry about any of those.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, it's not like Gambit, just stupid.
I'm gonna fight you, Nick.
This has been another episode of the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. This episode was produced by Mike Rappin and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Mike Snow, Churches, Lights, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep up with the Hybrid Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you'd like us to talk about something on the podcast, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. Also, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter @destroythecyb and follow us on Tumblr @destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And as always, thank you for listening.